Aziz Abu Sara is a peace and travel entrepreneur. He was born in a town in the West Bank and moved to East Jerusalem with his family when he was 16. I will let him tell his story of what happened to his older brother, Tassir, which marked a turning point in his life. It eventually led him to peace work and eventually led him to co-found Mejdi Tours, which are dual narrative tours beginning in Israel and Palestine, and now branching out to many other countries, including the U.S. And as I mentioned earlier, that is the tour company that will lead our two communities to a trip to the Civil Rights South. Today, Mejdi, as I mentioned, runs in over 20 different countries, and he continued to partner with Maoz Inon to co-found Interact, which we will be speaking out, they will be speaking about in just a few minutes. So it's a pleasure and honor to welcome Aziz.
And I have the great honor of welcoming Maoz Inon. Maoz and I actually met decades ago at Fawzi Azhar Inn in Nazareth, an inn and hostel that he worked and co-founded and brought to fruition a wonderful, fun, four-day hike called the Jesus Trail from Nazareth to Capernaum, which I earned my blisters on that hike. It was fantastic. Maoz is a peace entrepreneur, has been working on doing that through tourism within Israel, and we reconnected after his parents were killed on October 7th this last year and a half ago now. And during our conversation, we both connected over the fact that we were needing a little hope during that time. And Maoz, you reminded me at that conversation that we're not the only ones on this mountain, hoping and dreaming together for some peace. So I am delighted to be able to invite you to our Sukkah of Shalom, both Aziz and Maoz. We'd like to invite you on up for our conversation. I want to thank everybody right now who's made this event possible, from the Sparkers to the Etsniks to the musicians to the children to the leaders, those who have worked hard to make this event possible and are not in the room right now to make sure that our kids are having a wonderful time. And thank you to each one of you. Every single one of you chose on a Sunday afternoon with some beautiful weather to come and lean in for peace and hope. And we know we need it, don't we? So please welcome Maoz Inon and Aziz Abu Sara.
All right, awesome. Thank you, thank you. This reminded me, growing up, my English wasn't great. And when I was learning Hebrew, I remember being invited by somebody in my Hebrew class who said she wanted me to go out with her. And I thought that was fantastic. She's like, let's meet at the YMCA. There's a concert. I'm taking you out. That's what I thought she said. I showed up and there was a concert, except it was a church service. And as I started singing, and I still remember the song, I have decided to follow Jesus. I'm like, I think she did not invite me to a concert. Anyway, I ended up going to a Bible college after. And in the Bible college, we would go and do the singing. And one day they asked about everyone's talent. And we talk him around in the music-wise. And then it came to me and they're like, oh, what Aziz's talent? And somebody there goes, listening. Preferably he does not join the singing. So I'm sitting next to Maoz, torturing him today as I'm singing as loud as I could. But a lot of good memories. So just wanted to start with something a bit light as we go into a bit deeper and more painful stuff, and then moving toward hope and our work together.
Thanks, Aziz. Thanks, Pastor Daniel, Rabbi Chaim. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for coming. So I wasn't supposed to be here because I was supposed to fly out of Israel on Friday. But because there was a peace conference in Paris, I flew a day earlier to Paris. And landing in Paris or waking up in the morning, I learned that Israel waged war on Iran. And then we were doing a peace conference, 300 Palestinian Israelis in Paris. And we were asking ourselves and also people from our communities, Palestinians, Israelis, friends, ask us, what are you talking about peace? No, there is war going on. And there was a very famous rabbi, one of the first rabbis that basically reinvented Judaism after the destruction of the Second Temple. Rabbi Yossi Aglili was one of the Tanaim. And he said, peace is so great that in time of war, you should do nothing but starting with peace. Peace is so great. And when the world around us is collapsing and the reality is basically failing to give us security and safety and certainty, it's the time for prophecy. Prophets are showing up when the world is collapsing. And prophets, as I see it, have two roles. The first one is to tell the common people and the leaders the status quo, that the world that you are trying to hold together in your last efforts is falling apart. And if you continue to hold it, it's going to crash on you and will bring a great destruction. You should act differently than what you have done so far. And the second role is to show the path. To show the path. And my world collapsed on October 7th. My parents in Netiv HaAsara, it's the nearest Israeli community to the border with Gaza, just on the north part. We have here Noah, my childhood friend from Nachal Oz, which is a bit further down south, but also maybe a mile away, even less from the border. My father sent us a message in the group that Saturday morning that there is a war. And missiles and shooting and sirens. So I woke up around 7 a.m. in Binyamina, where we have Shani, yes, Yuval and Lilach are here from Binyamina, yeah. Anyone else from Binyamina? No. Yeah? Yes. Hey. So waking up in Binyamina, it's halfway between Tel Aviv and Haifa, a small town, reading this message, and as crazy as it might sound, it's normal. Every few months, we would get this message from my parents. So I've done nothing but making coffee to my beloved Shlomit, my partner for the last 30 years. And as the coffee was boiling, I start seeing in the news that Hamas is intruding Israeli communities and Toyota trucks of Hamas are in Sderot. So I call my parents at 7:30 and my father answer, and he tells me exactly what he said in the message, that there is a war outside. There is a war outside. So they lock the house. They are in the safe room. I could hear my mom in the background. So I told my father, Daddy, I love you. I love mom. And talk to you soon. And I called them soon after, 10 minutes after, at 7:40. And this time there was no answer. So I called my three sisters that live in Israel. Wake up my brother who lives in London. And we tried to reach out, my mom, my father, their neighbors, our friends from the community, no one answered. So we decided to gather together at my sister's house to wait, to see what's happening. And about 4 in the afternoon, we were able to reach one of the neighbors, and he was courageous enough to tell us that my parents' house is burned to ashes and that there are 2 bodies inside. So we've decided to start the first Shiva of the war. It was our family. We didn't wait for any announcement or official something. We just started the Shiva Sunday morning. And every morning of the Shiva, we opened the 5 siblings, the children of Jacobi and Bila. And then during the day, hundreds of people would come to condolence and sons. And during the evening, we just gathered with our partners and the 8 adult grandchildren of my parents. And it was Monday morning that my young brother Magen asked the family to send a universal message from our own private tragedy. And he wanted this message to be that we are rejecting revenge. We don't want to revenge the death of our parents. And he explained it very logically. Revenge is not going to bring them back. It's not going to bring them back. Revenge will only escalate the cycle of bloodshed, of hate, of of fear or in revenge that we are trapped within for over a century now. It didn't start on October 7th. It didn't start in the second Intifada or the first Intifada, or not even in 68 and not even in 48. For a century, we, the Israeli and Palestinians, are trapped within a cycle of violence. And my brother is telling us, I want our family to break the cycle. I want our family to start a new path. And that night, I was in bed in Binyamina. I was crying, and my entire body was in pain that I've never witnessed before, such kind of pain. And as I was crying, I could see the entire humanity in my dream. And we were all, I could see all of you. I could see everyone. And we were all crying. We cried and cried, and our tears went down our face to our bodies. And our bodies were wounded. They were crushed. They were bleeding. They were burned. And we cried and cried, and our tears started washing our bodies. And our tears healed us, cured us. We became whole again. And we kept crying and crying, and then our tears started going down to the earth. But we could not see grass. We cannot see flower. We couldn't see sand. The entire earth was soaked with blood. It was so horrible, so we kept crying. We cried and cried, and our tears start washing the blood from the earth, start purifying the land. And then the land became so beautiful, shining and glowing and inviting. And then I could see a path. I could see the path to peace and reconciliation. I woke up, and I have decided that if I want to heal myself, to cure myself, because for 3 days and three nights, I was drowning in an ocean of sorrow and pain. My entire body was broken into thousands of pieces. And I realized the only way to cure myself will be by choosing this path. I woke up in the morning, and I saw a message in my Facebook inbox. I saw a message from Aziz, sending his condolences and saying that he's standing with me and with my family in the hardest time. And since then, and now I'm proud and honored and privileged to say it. Yes, I lost my parents, but I won a brother. I won Aziz.
Thank you, Maoz. And again, thank you everyone for having us here. And in that morning when I sent Maoz that message, it was no question for me to do that, because being a peacemaker, peace activist, a peacenik already for years before, you already learned to transcend those lines of us versus them. And I've lost friends on that day. And then since then, I've lost many friends, people who I know and Maoz know, who've lost many family members in Gaza as well. And it's been, in some ways, a nightmare. Usually, we start by saying, every time we have to do this talk, things have gotten significantly worse. And every time we have to do it, we're already probably within that day have known somebody who lost a family member, or who have been injured, or have been suffering. And especially in those days where we know what's happening in Iran, in Israel, in Gaza, maybe less these couple of days about Gaza, but it's still going on. I think in the last 24 hours, 70 people or more have been killed. And to us, they are not numbers, because to us, we actually know usually family members of those, both Maoz and I do. So we're starting with that because we want to say our peace work is not about ignoring the reality. It's not about saying, oh, we see peace and we're just going to act like nothing is happening. It's exactly because of what's happening that we do this work. And it's because we believe that the pain and the anger that we experience is leading us more to work harder for an end to this madness. We can't accept this as a reality. And so we can sit and complain and cry about it, or we can do something about it. So what the two of us decided is that we will do things to change that reality, and we will use our pain and our anger. As a friend of mine taught me, anger and pain are like nuclear power. And nuclear power can cause two things. It can either cause destruction or it can create light. And yes, we all prefer if we don't use nuclear power at all. However, if we already have it, let's use it for light, not for weapons, not for destruction. So I wanted to start with that. My story is similar to Maoz's. I grew up in just outside Jerusalem in Bethany. I think a little more interesting than Benyamina. I'm sorry.
They both start with it. I doubt it, but... so.
Lazarus was raised from the dead in Bethany. You cannot beat that. Sorry. But they both start with a B.
Yeah, they start with exactly. Aziz already know what I'm going to answer him. It's not fair.
So I grew up in Bethany. It was a very small town when I grew up in. It's grown much, much more since then. But there's no normal childhood where I grew up. So things we're talking about didn't just start in the last couple of years or year and a half. I grew up under occupation, military occupation. It meant, one of the stories I like often to tell, it meant when I went to school, unlike most of you, what did you take with you when you go to school? What were the important things you had to take with you?
Lunch.
What is that?
Lunch.
I love that. That's always the first answer. It's like, yeah, we're going to school, but food comes first. All right, lunch. What else? Like backpack, books, homework, maybe some of you did it. Who knows? I took with me an onion. Anybody knows why an onion? Tear gas, right? This is an educated group. And at 7 or 8 years old, to think about taking an onion with you, that's not normal. But that's what it meant to grow up in a place where going to school meant sometimes being tear gassed and me being afraid to go to school because I was afraid of the tear gas, and me trying to convince my mom that I shouldn't go to school because education is not worth dying for. And I think I've made a really good case for it, but unsuccessfully. But that's what it meant to growing up in Jerusalem or in the suburbs of Jerusalem. This is me back in the day when I was good looking. I'm that little one there. I think I told you this story. I saw a family friend who've known me since I was a kid, and then we moved to Jerusalem, so she hasn't seen me in like 30 years. And then she sees me, and she's like, Aziz, what happened to you? You used to be the cutest kid. I'm like, what a nice neighbor. Thank you. Used to be cutest kid. All right. But that's my older brother, Taysir. I'm the youngest of seven. Because being the youngest of seven, Taysir was the person who took care of everything pretty much in my life. And in Ramadan, when I was 9 years old, a group of soldiers broke into our home, arrested Taysir on allegedly suspicion of throwing rocks. He was taken to prison, refused to confess, was beaten up, tortured in prison. By the time he was released, he was already pretty much dying, had internal injuries, took him to a hospital in Jerusalem, and a few days after he ended up, after the surgery, he ended up dying from his injuries. I was 10 years old then, and Taysir, who you see him in the photo here, was 19. And you can imagine what you go through when such a thing happens. It makes you angry, it makes you bitter, and it makes you want revenge. And that's how I grew up. I grew up very angry, very bitter, and very much wanting revenge. I joined the Fatah Youth Movement when I was a kid. Already by the time I was 13, I was active. By the time I was 16, I was in the leadership of the group. And that became the most important thing literally in my life. And did it until I was 18 years old when I realized that I needed to study Hebrew. Even though it was mandatory to study Hebrew in my high school, I refused to learn it because it was the language of those who killed my brother. That's how I saw it. I still passed all my exams, by the way, but I'm not going to tell you the secret to that. Just in case our young people, we don't want to give them bad advice. But it was going to study Hebrew that had massive impact on my life, because it was in that Hebrew class. I went to an ulpan, which is where Jewish immigrants to Israel go to study Hebrew, and we went to the same ulpan. So this is kind of amazing. I haven't met many people who've gone to the same ulpan. I was in King George Street. It was walking distance at the time. Also, wow. So it was your first time meeting a Palestinian. It was my first time meeting Israelis who were not, you know, the other, as soldiers, as settlers, you know, so on. And it was in King George Street, walking distance from my home. And I remember going into that class and feeling very uncomfortable. I didn't want to be there. I already had determined I'm going to learn a language, not to make friends, so I'm not going to talk to anyone, which is apparently doesn't work if you're trying to learn a language. You got to be really good at learning without speaking it. But it's through that class that I ended up meeting Israelis, meeting Jews who were talking about Palestinians like equals. And I've never experienced such a thing. I often talk about how my teacher walked to me in the first day, noticing how uncomfortable I was. And she just greeted me in a few words in Arabic. And that was the first time I felt an Israeli has talked to me like a human being. And it's small acts, actually. Sometimes it's the smallest things that make people start thinking. And then for the next few months, I went through a transformation. And that's eventually what ended up leading me to doing a lot of work in peace organizations. You know, Ben here, we were together involved with Combatants for Peace, which I've been involved in for 20 years almost since it was founded, Parent Circle and many other groups. And then in the last couple of years, Maoz and I with Interact, and we'll talk to you more about it.
Yeah, I have my own. So, like as you said, in the last year and a half, not just only we are speaking and starting from a lower point and the abyss is just getting deeper and deeper. At the beginning, just after October 7th, and I was also interviewed in many media outlets, I was saying that nothing can prepare you, anyone here, or definitely myself, for such a tragic moment to lose not only my both parents, but so many of my childhood friends, their children, their parents, neighbors that will be killed or kidnapped to Gaza. Right? Nothing can prepare you. But then as the week passed, I realized that I was wrong. I was prepared. I was prepared for the moment. And not only me, but my sisters and brother. We were all prepared. And you can guess, right? Who prepared us? Our parents. Our parents. I was growing up in a small kibbutz, Niram, a mile away from the border in Gaza, and my father was the manager of the farm. It's like the manager of the farm is like being the son of the god. If it's Palo Alto, it's like my father will be the founder of one of the biggest IT company. Everyone would know you, and he's getting the newest tractors and combine harvester. He's like a kind of god. And I was his child. And every evening we would dine, not in the dining room, but in her house. And everyone will share about his day and what his experience during the last day. And my father will always share how devastating and the current catastrophe in the fields. That's how being a farmer in the Negev, nearly the Israeli desert, is like. There are floods. Droughts, insects, heat wave, cold wave, wildfires. Every day was a new catastrophe. But then while he was saying that, he would also say, next year, I'm going to sow wheat again. Because next year is going to be a better year. I will learn from my mistakes. I will consult with other farmers. I will get the best seeds. I will fertile the land. I will open it for the rainwater to come. And I would sow, not just with faith, but knowing that next year will be better because I have the agency. Not to predict the future, but to change it. And during the last 18, 19 months, I've been also going through a spiritual journey. And on one of these days, I was able to look inside my body and to read what's my DNA, how I my cells are programmed. And I was reading that each part in my body knows that next year will be better. But now it's my turn. My turn to change the future. And now it's my turn and our turn to sow. To sow three seeds. The seeds of hope, the seeds of the future, and the most precious and rare and difficult to cultivate, the seeds of forgiveness. And like in the book of Tehillim, Psalms, is written, yeah, one day I will get it, but it's good. It's written, those who sow with tears will harvest with joy. So what we are doing now is very, very difficult, and I can assure you that because I'm a son of a farmer, the best farmer in Israel, actually. And I have proof of it, and the proof is here, because here is the formula in those small battles, the formula, are we going to harvest peace by 2030? Okay, mark my words. By 2030, we are going to harvest peace. It's not going to happen one day, not in our generation, not in our lifetime, by 2030. And later I will share with you the formula. And hope, like Danielle said before, hope is not something we can find, not something we can lose, or it's not something someone else will give us. Hope is an action. Hope is an action. And when Aziz and I were preparing for our TED Talk, which when we opened the TED convention in Vancouver in 2024, we were the first talk of the entire convention, and we were talking between us and with our friends how in 30 seconds we can explain how we can all create hope. So are you listening? Yes. Hope is an action that we create together with others by envisioning a better future and acting to make it into reality. It's as simple as that. And sitting here in Etz Chaim and Spark, this beautiful sanctuary, you are creating hope. If someone 50 years ago, 100 years ago, will tell you two different congregation, communities, Christian and Jewish, we're going to sit together and walk together and share the same values and the same space, it will be unthinkable. But here we are today. This is exactly how hope is created. And there are so many organizations, individuals, NGOs, civil society that are creating hope on the land, in the land right now. And some of them were here. I know Standing Together were here. The Family Circle were here. And there are so many of us that creating hope as we speak now. And I encourage you all to act together with others and creating hope. The second seeds are the seeds of the future. And Aziz and I were gathering with 70 other Israelis and Palestinians in Geneva, only a few months after the war started, and we said, let's leave the past and the present outside. We are not going to agree. Definitely as the war is still escalating, we are not going to agree on the past, and we cannot even agree on the present. We see totally different realities, totally different narratives and stories. But let's see if we can sit and agree about the future. And those are the seeds of the future that is based on a common ground. Equality and dignity, shared acknowledgement and recognition, reconciliation and healing, security and safety. Those are the values of the future. And we are on the same side. We are all on the same side of this future. And the most difficult seeds are the seeds of forgiveness. And later on also with the question, the difficult question will be directed to Aziz, and I will take the easy one. But I learned about forgiveness from Aziz. I learned from Aziz that when you are seeking revenge, you are basically a slave to those who hurt you, those who killed your loved one. You are living the destiny they choose for you. You are not free. You are a slave. And by forgiving, You choose your own freedom. You're forgiving for yourself. It doesn't matter if the other side, those who harmed you, they listen, they care, they're going to do something. You do it only for yourself to find peace within you. And I wanted to revenge after October 7th. I wanted to revenge, not in the Hamas, because for me, what Hamas was doing on October 7th is written in his charter. This is was his promise, to kill innocent Jewish Israelis. I remember Hamas throwing out from the balconies in Gaza the Fatah people back in 2007. Hamas
it's
is
exactly this is anniversary.
Yeah, Hamas is extremist fundamental organization that is killing and oppressing his own people. And if he can find Jewish Israelis, even better. But I was furious and wanted to revenge the Israeli government that promise our family, our communities, security and safety. They built the most invested wall humanity ever built. Only it was shading, literally shading my parents' house. The highest, the deepest electronic device down deep in the ground and up in the air. And they failed. So I was seeking revenge. And I had a scenario. I envisioned how I'm going to make them pay and take my revenge. And then I had an intervention for my family and some really close friend, and they told me, Moaz, yes, you're going to succeed, but it's going to take you down too. And basically Aziz, and that's what maybe what I'm most thankful for you, he gave me the letter, but also the conscience that I can choose differently. I can choose to reject revenge, and I can choose to work towards a better future for us all. Thank you, Aziz. Thank you.
Wow. Amazing. I can just listen to my house, so it's okay. I think one of the things we learned as well, 10 minutes, okay. I have about just 10 minutes of things I want to say.
I need to.
One of the things I learned was the power of empathy and how much we're lacking it. And I would say if there's one thing I like to see changing in our societies, in Israel, in Palestine, and definitely around the world, is reconnecting with what empathy means and to overcome this idea that the world is run as an us versus them. Moaz is Israeli, I'm Palestinian, therefore we must be on the opposite side. You Jewish or you Christian or you Muslim, then you must support the Israeli government, you must support what Hamas did, you must support... And this binary thinking is quite destructive. And I see it even with people. We were in London recently, met some incredible, incredible people. But when it comes to this conversation, people very quickly revert to tribalism and feeling, but I must support this or that. Talk to friends the last couple of days who like right away went, I support Israel against Iran. I support Iran against Israel. And this binary thinking is something we both reject and we believe is exactly why we are where we are today. Who you support, but it's not even who you support, who you against is what it has become. By supporting this, you must be against that. And putting our faith so much in horrific leadership, like I have friends in Israel who cannot stand Netanyahu or his government. But at the same time, they're like, oh, but we think this war might be good. Like, if you don't trust a leader, you don't trust their decisions, definitely I wouldn't want to march with somebody I don't trust to war. That's me. I don't know. But for a lot of people, maybe it's different. So this is one area. As we say, if you're going to divide us, don't divide us as Israelis versus Palestinians. Don't divide us as Muslim versus Jews versus Christians. Don't divide us as good and bad kind of thing. If you must divide us, then it's those who believe in equality, in justice, in peace, in coexistence, and those who don't yet. And our mission is exactly how do we make that, kind of mentioned the tent earlier that's open from every side, the Abraham tent, how do we get everyone to be part of that tent? And I think acts of empathy are very, very important. And you don't do them to expect people to respond. So Maoz told you I sent him a message right after his parents were killed. I didn't expect a response. I think when you do an act of kindness and an act of empathy. If you do it for a response, you're going to be disappointed a lot of times. And I'm telling you this because Maoz wasn't the first person I ever sent this message to. 10 years earlier is the first time I did it. And it was when there was a Palestinian guy walked into a synagogue and killed a few men who were praying there. And being from Jerusalem, I felt I needed to respond. But I didn't just want to do something public. I decided to send a letter to each one of these widows. And I'm not going to read you the whole letter, but I'm going to maybe read you a small part of it. And I decided to do it knowing that the likelihood is that they wouldn't respond. And they didn't. And I'm not, you know, I told somebody recently about it, and he was trying to explain to me why they didn't respond and I shouldn't be upset. Not upset. I think most people don't. But I think it does make an impact whether they did or not. So I wrote, I have sat for an hour trying to figure out how to start this letter, unable to make a complete sentence. We have never met, and I have never written a condolence letter to someone I haven't met. I'm sorry for your loss doesn't seem to cut it. Please accept my condolences seems too weak. But then there are no words anyone can say to make the pain any less. And then I go through an advice that a friend of mine, a rabbi, gave me of explaining from the Talmud why I should write this letter. I'm going to spare you that because it's very technical. Yes, that's for the Friday sermon. Then I go, well, I explain that the idea of someone, anyone, can murder civilians while they are praying in their holy place gives me a tight, nauseous feeling in my chest. A holy place should be a safe place where people can see God. It is a place where people should be able to go and wrestle in silence their soul bare before their creator. Violating the sacred place and the lives therein is a special kind of a crime. While I have many political grievances against Israel, there is no justification for murder. No circumstance, no matter how grievous, should blunt our ability to see the others as a human. I learned from the Prophet, Prophet Muhammad, forgive him who he wrongs you, join him who cuts you off, do good to him who does evil to you, and speak the truth even if it be against yourself. Our humanity, which is grounded in the fact that we are all created in God's image, is the one thing that we have to hold onto. And in attacking your husband, someone forgot this lesson. I know this very well because my brother was killed when I was 10. I know the pain and the anger. I know the feelings of loss, the emptiness, the unanswered questions. I know how it feels to receive the knock on the door or the phone call to confirm your greatest fear. This conflict claiming lives of our loved ones, I'll bypass some of that, but I want to end with, I'll keep praying that the days described by Prophet Isaiah are not far off when he said they will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations will learn to take up swords against nation, will not take up swords. I'm like, I missed something. Nor will they train for war anymore. I wrote it right. I had a few people go over it before I sent it too. It seems an impossible prayer in such circumstances, but sometimes hope and faith are the best acts of resistance. So I was already on board. We can offer. I'm so sorry I cannot offer anymore. But, you know, as the Bible says, may God comfort you among all the other mourners of Zion and Jerusalem. And I think this is exactly what we are trying to do in Interact. We are trying to show what empathy looks like. Maoz and I and our team, we are trying to, this is a good one. We are reaching out to people in powerful places and speaking to them, not just for the photo op, although that is awesome. Being hugged by Pope Francis is one of the most powerful things we've both experienced in our lives and very grateful for it. And meeting Pope Leo was very powerful as well. But more importantly, talking to them and telling them our vision and having them advance that vision. Pope Francis took what we asked him to do to the G7 meeting and got the G7 to adopt every word, literally word by word, of what we asked them to do. And our names don't show up in that, but it was for the peace movement. It wasn't for our organization or for the two of us. It was, how can we get the G7 to advance peacemaking? And our message is very simple. Stop investing in war and start investing in peacemaking. Stop sending weapons to our region, because that will never solve any problems. We know already that for the last whatever many years you want to think of. And start inviting peacemakers to your meetings. Something we keep pushing is why there are no peacemakers, not in any negotiation sessions, not in, you know, presidents, members of Congress, even. They don't usually talk to people like us. And we are trying to change that reality, not just the two of us, but for the whole community of peacemakers. We don't want to only talk to you. We love you. But our goal is to also speak to those who are making decisions. And to get to them, we have to talk to you too, because you have that power to get us there. While we are here, we're meeting with the chief of staff of the governor. That didn't happen because they think Maoz and I are cool. It happens because, also, maybe, but the best-looking peace activists, we normally say. But it's happening because people here have made phone calls on our behalf and said, the governor needs to meet, or his staff need to meet peacemakers. And so we're changing the paradigm in the sense of changing who's at the table. It starts with who's sitting where decisions are being made. And we are saying it's not enough for us to just tell them. We need to be there. We need to be on the table. We need to tell them what we think works and doesn't work. We have way more experience how this works than any of these guys who end up at negotiation tables, which are normally generals and lawyers. And with all love and respect to lawyers, you know, we think we should be there as well. So we'll... Some, yeah. Some politicians even are peacemakers. A few, but, you know, we've met some. We were in Congress, and we've met some and really made a couple amazing relationships. This week, actually, a senator's office called me. I didn't think I even told you about this. And said, we know about the Saudi French initiative. We want to help. How can the senator help? What can he do to be of support? Behind the scenes, public, let's talk about it. And I got this random phone call from a senator from the Foreign Affairs and Home Security Advisor of the senator to talk about how can they support it. So that's how we start making change. Now, we're doing a lot of other things, but we'll probably leave that for the Q&A. And I'll let Maoz...
I will share with you. We have 2-3 minutes more, okay? How are we going to make...
It's more than 2-3 minutes, but
Aziz, you are on my side.
I am. I'm giving you more time.
No, there we... So what's in this battle was never achieved by humanity. This is... There is a sesame oil that was harvested by a machine, by a combined harvester. Humanity never achieved it before. And with high production per hectare. So peace was achieved so many times. So many times in the past. All conflicts end in the end. And peace was achieved between the U.S. and Germany, between U.S. and Japan, between U.S. and Vietnam. There was a reconciliation between Israel and Germany. There was a reconciliation between the Hutu and the Tutsi in Rwanda. That exactly today, 31 years ago, there was a genocide. More than 1 million people were murdered. And everywhere we go around the globe, we see a conflict that ended. But this was never achieved. And my father and two of his partners, one of them was Asaf Avneri, Noah, from our class. who became my father's partner and a professor from the Faculty of Agronomy in Israel. They went on a farming expedition to Ethiopia. Ethiopia is the land of the sesame. And Asaf and Tzvika are coming back to Israel and sharing with my father that in Ethiopia, they are cultivating millions of hectares of sesame. Millions of hectares that produce very little per hectare and all being harvested by hand. Hundreds of thousands of Ethiopians going to the fields at the harvest time and they harvest by hand. So Tzvika, Asaf and my father, Jacobi, they start dreaming of a dream that humanity was never able to achieve, a sesame variety that will be harvested by a machine with high production. That's the first step in the formula to dream. The second, they decided what's going to be the values, like your beautiful wall. What will be the values of this sesame variety? Resilience for climate change, high nutrition values, and that it will be cultivated in Israel. And then they move to the third step, which is to building a coalition, a partnership, because no one can fulfill a big dreams on his own. And then they move to the first step to write a roadmap, a plan, how they will be able to cultivate this divine sesame variety. And they made a very, very detailed plan, and they thought that by the year of 2025, so from 2008, it will take them something like 17 years to achieve this dream. And then they move to the fifth step, which is implementing and start executing the plan. And they were ahead of time in a year and a half, only 2 weeks after October the 7th, for the first time on planet Earth, a sesame variety was harvested by a machine in Israel, producing 10 times more sesame per hectare from what they started from. So it's going to change the diet of the 9 billion people living on planet Earth nowadays. And I will read from the label. The Jacobi sesame variety was cultivated at the Hebrew University Faculty of Agriculture as a premium high-quality oil variety suited for Israel farming. The variety is dedicated in the memory of our friend, Jacobi Inon, an agronomist, agriculture advisor, worker and lover of the land, known for his vast knowledge, integrity, and modesty. Daniel and Chaim, I have one for you, for each. So please, come.
As if you give to Chaim.
And this is exactly how we're going to achieve peace. We have a dream. We are sharing our values, dignity, equality, shared acknowledgement and recognition, reconciliation and healing, security and safety. We are now forming a very powerful and strong coalition. This is why we are here. We are not here just to speak to you. And we are not here just to listen. We are here to ask you to be our partners. And Daniel and Chaim, we are already partners, but we want each one from your beautiful two communities to be our partners. We have a roadmap, and we are already executing. And I will just share the last. This is, I see many mothers here, many mothers and some boys. So I have a secret to tell you, the mothers. When you give us something to your boys, written or a blessing, we never read it. Sorry for telling it, for being honest, we never read it. And in 2016, my mom blessed me with this mandala. My mom was a mandala painter. Only after October 7th, I read it for the first time. I will start with Hebrew and then in English. Kol ha-chalomot shelanu yecholim leitgashem im yeh lanu ha-omets lirdof achrem. All our dreams can be fulfilled if we have the courage to chase them. And I have many, many of those postcards. It's really beautiful to decorate your refrigerator or in the car, so you can pick one. And I'll just read what Pope Francis told Aziz and me last year. Let us not sow death destruction or fear, let us sow hope. Thank you.
He didn't only tell it to us, he put it on his Instagram too. He didn't just tell it to us, he posted it on his Instagram account, wow, which was pretty cool.
Should we?
Yes. Can you all thank Aziz and Mo'oz one more time? That's incredible. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So fortunate and so blessed to be in the room together and to be able to have this conversation, to lean in, and in days and weeks and months and years like these, to make some hope together, to make peace together. We want to invite all of you to join the beautiful work of Interact. There will be QR code up here if you would like to continue to partner with Aziz and Mo'oz and with their organizations to be able to continue to bring reconciliation and peace and hope to the land. Please consider investing in this community. We are going to start to also turn towards the practice of a meal together. And in both Islam and Christianity and in Judaism, the practice of a shalom meal, a solcha even, an opportunity to come together and practice reconciliation and community and friendship building and forgiveness together is such a gift. So we are going to turn to a meal with one another. So if you've RSVP'd to join the meal, please join us. If you didn't, just stand at the back of the line. We'll all try to make sure there's some share. This is a light refreshment. This is not a 5-course meal, everybody. So make sure, love your neighbor in front and behind you as you go through. We'll invite you all to go and do that. We would love to also, if you are participating through your community, through Spark Church or Etz Chaim, please make a donation to offset the cost of your participation in our event tonight. That would be such a blessing to all of us. With that, I'd like to turn over an opportunity. Rabbi Chaim, would you please give us a blessing for our dinner together?
There are different blessings that we say before eating, before sharing a meal together. One of them is very familiar, the motzi, to many Jewish people. It's giving thanks to God for bringing bread from the earth. We're actually going to say a different one this evening, which is shakol nihyeh bidvaro, which means that all that we are going to be eating, all that we are experiencing this evening, is according to a divine plan. However we understand God, however we understand the divine, there's something divine that brought us together. There's something that is connecting all of us this evening that motivated us to be together, whether you're joining from home or you're in the room tonight. So I'm going to say the blessing in Hebrew, and then I'll say it in English. And if you feel comfortable saying amen, please say amen. Baruch ata Adonai, Eloheinu melech haolam, shehakol nihyeh bidvaro. Blessed are you, creator of all, who gives us this opportunity to enjoy the sustenance, the physical nourishment that we will enjoy in a moment, as well as the spiritual and emotional nourishment of being together in community for the sake of peace and community. As together we say, amen. Please enjoy.